Executive Power, Disc 5.
Chapter 26. Rapp was willing to play the General's game for a while. Morrow would undoubtedly remain defiant right up to the moment he was confronted with the evidence. "Tell me, General, do you dislike America?" Morrow pondered the question with a puzzled look on his oily face. "I'm not sure what you are asking me." "It isn't a difficult question. Do you like America? Yes or no?" "That depends. There are things about America that I like, and there are things that I don't like." "Fair enough. What about China?" The Filipino's eyes screwed a bit tighter at hearing this. "I have no opinion on China." "Really?" asked Rapp in a surprised tone. "That surprises me." Any sense of Morrow's air of amusement had evaporated at the mention of the world's most populous country. "What are you hinting at, Mr. Rapp?" Changing gears, Rapp leaned back and said, "I would like to do business with you, General. As I said, I'm a practical man, and I've been told you are too. I want Abu Sayyaf crushed, and I don't care what it takes. If I have to pay a certain person large amounts of cash to make sure the job gets done, then that's what I'm willing to do." "I am not sure," said Morrow, squinting up at the tent ceiling, "but I think I am offended by what you have just proposed." Rapp looked him right in the eye and shook his head disbelievingly. "No, you aren't. As I've already said, I know certain things about you, and I know it is impossible that you're offended by what I just proposed." Morrow took in a deep breath and then exhaled slowly. It appeared that the American was privy to his business arrangement. Choosing his words carefully, he said, "What exactly did you come here for, Mr. Rapp?"
"I came to make you a better offer than the one you already have."
"I'm listening." The General leaned back and folded his arms across his chest. "We know about your accounts in Hong Kong and Jakarta. We know you've been spying for the Chinese since the early 80s, and we know Abu Sayyaf pays you off so that you don't get too aggressive in pursuing them." Morrow studied Rapp with cautious eyes, finally said, "I'm still listening. As I've already stated, I'm a practical man. Although I'm not entirely comfortable with your connection to Beijing, I can live with it for the time being. Abu Sayyaf is an entirely different matter. That I cannot live with."
"Mr. Rapp, I still have no idea what you are talking about."
Rapp reached into his vest pocket while keeping his eyes locked on Morrow. He pulled out an envelope and tossed it onto the General's desk. Rapp watched as Morrow emptied the envelope's contents and began leafing through the various pages. They consisted of bank and phone records. After Morrow was done looking over the documents, he placed them back in the envelope and set the package carefully in the middle of his desk. So the American did know his secret, or at least part of it. But Morrow was not willing to admit guilt so easily.
"I don't know what any of this is about."
In a deadpan voice, Rapp said, "There's more. We have radio and telephone intercepts. Your voice print has been matched beyond any reasonable doubt." Morrow stared unwaveringly at his adversary as he desperately scrambled for a way out of this ambush. After nearly a minute of silence, he decided there was only one option.
"How many people know about this?"
Morrow nodded at the envelope.
"Enough." "How many in my country?"
"A select few." The sour expression on Morrow's face betrayed his feelings about this piece of information.
"Does Colonel Barboza know?"
Barboza knew something, to be sure, but Rapp wasn't sure exactly what. Not wanting to complicate things, he answered, "No." Morrow nodded. The fact that the colonel was out of the loop seemed to offer him some comfort.
"It appears you have me at a disadvantage, Mr. Rapp. Why don't we get back to what you were talking about earlier?"
"The part about large amounts of cash."
"Yes," said Morrow, smiling.
Rapp returned the smile, despite the fact that he hated the man. As I already told you, I'm a practical man. Your relationship with the Chinese will be handled at a later date. For now, my main concern is dealing with Abu Sayyaf. Morrow nodded. I want the American family back, unharmed. And I want you to pursue Abu Sayyaf with such vengeance that they dare not take another American ever again. In fact, I would prefer it if you wiped them out entirely. This will not be easy. Rotting in a Philippine prison for the rest of your life would be much more difficult. The general's entire body tensed at the thought. I did not say it couldn't be done. Rapp nodded his approval. General, fear can be a wonderful motivator, but it does nothing to build long-term relationships. That is why I am going to make you an offer that I think you will like very much. Leaning forward, Rapp lowered his voice and said, If you return the entire Anderson family to us unharmed, I will see to it that $100,000 will find its way into an account of your choosing. If by year's end you have managed to pursue Abu Sayyaf to my satisfaction, you will receive an additional $100,000. If you succeed on both of these fronts, we will sit down and explore the possibility of further compensation in regard to your relationship with Beijing. With a wry smile, Morrow said, You would like to turn me into a double agent. Like I said, said Rapp, shrugging, let's see how our first two deals turn out, and then we'll go from there. Morrow sat there for a long moment, pondering the offer that had just been made to him. Rapp had played all of this out beforehand in his mind and had a pretty good inkling of what would happen next. In fact, he would be disappointed if Morrow didn't do as he'd predicted. Finally, Morrow tilted his head back slightly and said, Mr. Rapp, America is a very wealthy country. What you ask of me will take more resources than you have offered. If you wish to get the family of Americans back safely, I am going to need more. Rapp remained impassive, meeting the general's gaze with his own. Coleman and his men were obviously not in the position yet to carry out the mission, or they would have called. So it was up to him. The entire time he'd been talking to Morrow, he'd been refining a new plan. It would have to look like Morrow had shot himself rather than face a court-martial for committing treason. The general carried the standard Special Forces 9mm Beretta pistol. Rapp would use his own suppressed 9mm Beretta to shoot him in the side of the head and then eject a round from the general's gun and place the weapon in his hand. Rapp would then ask Colonel Barboza to come into the tent. They would wait for a minute and then leave. Barboza would then instruct the general's aide-de-camp that the general was considering something very important and did not want to be disturbed under any circumstances. They would then get on the helicopter and leave. Everyone would assume that the sound of the gunshot had been lost in the noise of the helicopter's departure. Then General Rizal would just have to make sure that only a cursory investigation of the body and the weapon took place. The general's body would be found sometime later, along with the evidence of the bank accounts and phone records. It would be plain to even the most simple-minded officer that Morrow had committed suicide rather than be publicly tried for crimes of high treason. The generals back in Manila would make sure the military investigators didn't delve too deeply into the forensics surrounding Morrow's death. Most people would understand that the proud and arrogant general would rather commit suicide than face a humiliating court-martial. Rapp finally answered the general. I am prepared to go to $200,000 to gain the safe return of the Andersons, but not a penny more. Morrow frowned.
That is still a little light. I'm afraid this is a game you are not well versed in, Mr. Rapp.
Is that right? Rapp asked in a doubtful tone. General, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm the one holding all the cards. My offer is final. $200,000 to get the Andersons back, and another $100,000 when you have effectively decimated Abu Sayyaf.
I'm not so sure, said Morrow, with a shake of his head.
Well, I am, added Rapp quickly. Push me any further, General, and you will be arrested right now and returned to Manila to face a court-martial. Colonel Barbosa will replace you, and with the help of the U.S. Special Forces, he will free the Andersons and rid this island of any and every terrorist connected to Abu Sayyaf." The general scoffed at his adversary's remark.
"Colonel Barbosa is an incompetent fool. If you want the Andersons back alive, I am the man to do it. Give me $300,000 and I will make it happen within 48 hours.
Rapp was straining to keep his temper in check. The sheer arrogance of Morrow was getting under his skin. He flexed his hands and then clenched them into tight fists, reminding himself that none of this mattered. It was all a ruse to get Morrow to relax. A look of calm washed over his face, and he said, "All right, General. I'll agree to your terms."
"Good," said a jubilant Morrow. "Now, here is what we will do."
Rapp smiled and nodded as Morrow enthusiastically talked about how he would deal with Abu Sayyaf. He was saying something about arranging for the release of the American family. Rapp continued to look interested while his left hand slowly moved toward his gun. His fingers were just parting the folds of his vest when it happened. His hand froze with indecision, and Morrow, noticing the change in his demeanor, stopped talking. Chapter 27 Coleman reached the summit of the small mountain, huffing and puffing from the breakneck pace he'd kept for nearly 20 minutes. With sweat covering every inch of his body, he took a knee and did a quick 180 of the relatively minute area before him. The summit was not big. A large, dark gray, almost black rock occupied almost one entire side of the crest. It was covered with a few stubborn trees and bushes, their roots running down into the rock's deep fissures. Directly in front of Coleman lay a gently sloping shelf covered in grass and shielded from the sun by several twisted trees. On first glance, he missed Wicker. Positioned between the base of a tree and a clump of bushes, the soles of Wicker's jungle boots were all that was visible. Coleman dropped to his belly and crawled through the knee-high grass. When he reached Wicker, he noticed that the more agile man had already unpacked and assembled his 50-caliber Beretta M82A1 rifle and was surveying the lay of the land through a pair of M1922 binoculars. Out of breath, but not the least bit embarrassed by it, Coleman asked, "What's the sit, Rep?" Wicker remained motionless as he peered through the powerful binoculars.
"I did a quick check of the perimeter, and it looks like we're alone."
"Any sign of Mitch?"
"No, but we've got a Huey down there with a pair of hot engines and a very nervous colonel standing outside of General Morrow's tent."
Coleman frowned. "How in the hell do you know it's Morrow's tent?"
"Because someone was dumb enough to hang a sign with his name and rank on it."
"You're shitting me."
"Nope. Have a look for yourself."
Wicker handed Coleman the binoculars and nestled in behind his high-powered rifle scope. The former SEAL commander did a quick check at the camp and announced,
"Well, if that isn't one of the stupidest things I've ever seen."
Wicker silently concurred while he used his scope to check out several likely spots where an enemy sniper might be lying in wait. He was a cautious man by nature, but he was also extremely confident in his skills. This Philippine Special Forces group didn't appear to be a crack outfit. From the sign hanging on the general's tent to the lack of perimeter security, it looked like a truly sloppy operation. The odds that they'd deployed a counter-sniper team seemed unlikely. Even more in his favor, though, was the distance of the shot that he was to take. There were only a handful of men in the world who could execute a headshot at this distance. If there was a counter-sniper team about, they would be focusing on a perimeter of 500 meters, give or take 100 meters. Wicker was well outside that range. Even so, he was breaking many of his own rules. They'd arrived while the sun was up, and he'd slithered into position without donning his ghillie sniper suit. Covered with netting and burlap strips in various shades of green, the sniper suit allowed him to disappear into the terrain. If given proper time, he would have added the natural vegetation of his surroundings to the suit, ultimately making him invisible to even the most well-trained pair of eyes.
"What do you think?" asked Coleman. "I think these guys aren't real worried about being attacked."
Next came the important question. "Can you make the shot?" Wicker brought the crosshairs of his scope back to the general's tent and centered them on the colonel's head. Moving his eye away from the glass aperture, he looked to the east at the rising sun. The horizon was ablaze with a brilliant bank of storm clouds. For now the weather was acceptable. There was no wind yet. But that would undoubtedly change as the front approached. Wicker eased his left eye back behind the scope and said,
"Tell him I can handle it."
Coleman, who was still breathing heavily, marveled at the sniper's calm demeanor. After retrieving the satellite phone from one of his thigh pockets, he punched in a number and waited. Chapter 28. The Director General of Mossad leaned forward and stared intently at one of the large screens. It showed a section of one of the nastiest neighborhoods in all of Israel. The analyst, to Friedman's right, spoke in hushed tones.
"Look at the roadblocks."
With a laser pointer, the man marked the three avenues of access to the hillside neighborhood.
"And look at the four men on this rooftop right here."
He circled the roof of the building in red light.
"Lookouts?"
questioned Friedman.
"That and probably more."
The man said something into his headset and the rooftop was magnified.
"I'm 90% sure two of those men are carrying RPGs."
Friedman looked at the grainy black, green, and white image. It was being shot from the underbelly of a customized DHC-7 four-engine turboprop. Part of an aid package from the United States, the plane was outfitted with the Highly Integrated Surveillance and Reconnaissance System, or HISAR. The plan was designed to provide both image and signal intelligence in real time. The men on the rooftop with rocket-propelled grenades were not unexpected. Since the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia back in 1993, every terrorist in the Middle East had realized how easy it was to shoot down a hovering helicopter. For this and several other reasons, Friedman had ruled out sending in a team of commandos. There were other, less risky ways to handle the job. Friedman shifted his glance to one of the other large screens. It gave a broader picture of Hebron. In the center of it, a laser dot marked the roof of a sedan that was speeding through the streets. With each passing moment, the tiny car worked its way closer to the hillside neighborhood that they'd already identified. It looked like things were going to work. Suddenly, the sedan stopped at a roadblock that had gone unnoticed. The man on Friedman's right spoke into his headset, and almost immediately, the airborne low-light camera zoomed in on the roadblock. The room watched tensely as several people got out of the car. One of them walked to the rear of the sedan and placed two objects on the trunk. Others gathered around.
"Give me full magnification on the trunk of that car," barked Friedman.
Several tense seconds passed, and then they were treated to a welcome sight. It looked like the two attaché cases were still in play. Friedman watched as they were closed. He muttered something unintelligible to himself and blinked several times. The entire room watched in silence as the man with the cases was led through the roadblock and into a waiting van. The camera zoomed out, following the van as it wound its way up the narrow streets. A digital clock on the wall above the TVs crept downward from 5 minutes. In 2 minutes and 28 seconds, the burst transmitter would send confirmation of the location of the attaché cases, and then the waiting would be over. All at once, the four large screens fell into sync, and at the center of each was the house they had expected to see. Friedman watched as the van carrying his instrument of retribution stopped directly in front of the target. Needing no further confirmation, he turned to the general on his left and nodded. Hovering at 500 feet on the outskirts of Hebron lurked two of the most efficient killing machines ever built by man, or, more precisely, the Boeing Corporation of America. The AH-64D Apache Longbow helicopter was an unrivaled lethal machine. Its fire control radar target acquisition system allowed it to classify and prioritize up to 125 targets in just seconds. Even more impressive was the system's ability to designate the 16 most dangerous targets and engage them with the Longbow's fire-and-forget Hellfire laser-guided missiles or AIM-9 Sidewinder air-to-air missiles. The Apache Longbow is the most advanced attack helicopter in the world, and in some people's minds, the most advanced flying machine in the world. The two birds had been on station for 36 minutes. patiently awaiting their orders. They'd lifted off from their airfield in the Negev and proceeded north, avoiding all towns and roadways. The longbows that had been on station since late afternoon had returned to base to refuel. Floating on the other side of a small ridgeline, 8 kilometers from Hebron, the 2 choppers were running dark, their navigation lights extinguished. Each helicopter was configured for a multi-role mission. They carried 8 Hellfire missiles, 38 Hydra 70mm folding fin aerial rockets, and 1,200 rounds of 30mm ammunition for their belly-mounted chain guns. The amount of firepower that the Apache could carry was not what set it apart from other helicopters. The chopper, in fact, had rivals that could carry almost twice the amount of firepower. What set the Apache longbow apart was its accuracy, stability, and maneuverability. It was an all-weather attack helicopter designed to engage multiple targets with a focus on armor. The Apache had been designed as a tank killer, but its designers had been so successful that its mission had grown. At the start of the Gulf War in 1991, it was the Apache that fired the first shots. Led by a Pave-Low helicopter, a flight of Apaches snuck into Iraq under the radar, and using their sidearm anti-radar missiles, they punched a big hole in Iraq's air defense network. Through that hole poured hundreds of coalition fighters and bombers. Within hours, virtually the entire Iraqi air defense network was shut down. And that was more than a decade ago. Since then, the Apache had been given a complete overhaul that included the Longbow fire control radar, an improved navigation system, air-to-air capability, fire and forget missiles, and increased battlefield survivability due to improved engines, electrical systems, and avionics. Taking on buildings and lightly armed men was not what the platform had been designed for, but the men flying the machines were not about to argue with the bosses in Tel Aviv. If they wanted to use a hammer to kill a fly, that was their decision. The pilots and co-pilot gunners waited for their orders and monitored their various instruments. The pilots looked out at the surrounding area with their night vision sensors and monitored their ship's vitals, while the co-pilot gunners looked through their target acquisition designation sights. The surveillance plane circling above the city at 15,000 feet was sending a constant stream of information to the onboard fire control computers of the longbows. Multiple targets were painted with lasers. All that was left to do was arm the missiles and engage. The order to move came over the encrypted digital communications link. Simultaneously, the twin General Electric gas turbine engines on each bird increased power and the helicopters began to climb. They moved over the ridgeline, closing on the city of Hebron at a cautious 50 knots. With each passing second, the fire control computers effortlessly calculated a new solution to each target. In less than a minute, the town of Hebron would be ablaze. Chapter 29. His fingers had just touched the cool black steel of his Beretta when he felt his satellite phone vibrate. Rapp froze for only a second, but Morrow noticed. In an attempt to conceal his tension, Rapp smiled and said, "I'll never get used to these damn vibrating phones." He withdrew his hand from the Beretta and grabbed the phone from his belt. "Excuse me, General, I've been waiting for this call." Morrow flashed a forced smile and nodded. He was now watching Rapp's movements with greater interest. "Hello," Rapp answered. He listened for a moment and then replied, "Yes, it's a deal. He's offered to join forces with us." Rapp listened for another few seconds. "It's going to cost us slightly more than we talked about, but the general convinced me he could make it happen." Rapp smiled and nodded to the general. "Yep, okay. The ball's in your court. I can fill you in on the rest of the details when I get back." Rapp listened again briefly and then said, "Yep, it's a go. All right, goodbye." He pressed the end button and put the phone away, saying, "They are very pleased, General. They're not crazy about you upping the price, but if you follow through on your promises, no one's going to complain." "Good." Morrow seemed to relax a bit. "Now," Rapp said, getting up, "if you'll excuse me, I have to get back to Manila and take care of some more business. If you need any assistance in carrying out your missions, don't hesitate to ask." Morrow got up and extended his hand across the small desk. "Do not worry, Mr. Rapp. My men are some of the best in the world." He flashed Rapp a confident smile and pumped his hand. Rapp forced himself to return the smile and ignore the fact that Morrow was squeezing his hand a bit too firmly. He went to retract his hand, but Morrow did not let go.
"Tell me, Mr. Rapp,"
hissed Morrow in a conspiratorial tone,
"is General Rizal on your payroll?"
Rapp tried once again to retrieve his hand, but Morrow tightened his grip. Having absolutely no tolerance for such childish games, Rapp clamped down on Morrow's hand with vice-like pressure. Pulling the general toward him, he warned,
"General, don't fuck with me."
With a gleam in his eye and a slick smile, Morrow replied,
"I am the one who you should not fuck with. I am sickened by your country and your arrogance, and let's be very clear about something. You will never own me. I will meet the agreement we made here today, and that is as far as it goes. Tell that to your bosses back in Washington, and tell them if they don't like it, the Andersons will never see their home again. Now get out of my camp before I decide to have you shot."
Morrow released Rapp's hand with a shove. It took every ounce of restraint Rapp had not to level Morrow with a left cross to the jaw. This man had psychological issues that ran much deeper than anything he had been briefed on. The only thing that prevented him from pounding his psychotic ass into the ground was the fact that the best damn sniper in the world was sitting on a mountaintop a mile away, ready to bring this little drama to a much more final and beneficial conclusion. With that thought in mind, Rapp simply turned and left the tent. Just outside, he found Colonel Barboza and the general's aide-de-camp conversing. Rapp jerked his head toward the chopper and kept walking. After several strides, he pulled out his satellite phone and hit the speed dial number for Coleman. After a few seconds, the connection was made. "Did you see the tent I just came out of?" After a brief delay, Coleman's reply came back, "Affirmative." Looking ahead to the helicopter, Rapp twirled his finger in the air, signaling the pilots to start the engines. "That's where he is." Rapp was almost halfway to the chopper when he heard some shouting behind him. He turned to see Morrow standing in front of his tent wearing his holster. For a moment he thought the general was yelling at him, and then he realized his angry comments were directed at Colonel Barboza. The colonel, who had already started for the chopper, was now stopped about midway between Rapp and the general. Rapp couldn't hear the specifics of what was being said, but it appeared that the higher ranking of the two officers wanted the junior officer to ask permission to leave the camp. Rapp, fed up with Morrow's behavior, studied the situation pensively and then made a quick decision. Clutching the satellite phone, he asked Coleman one simple question. Coleman relayed Rapp's question to Wicker and waited. Wicker lay in the prone position, completely motionless. His left eye peered through the coated glass of his unertal scope. He'd already lasered the range to the target and made the adjustments for windage and elevation. He was in a near-trance-like state, and his heart had already slowed to a meager 32 beats a minute. Wicker pulled the trigger back one notch and said,
"Say the word."
Coleman took a quick look through his binoculars to make sure someone wasn't about to enter the line of fire. Satisfied that no one other than the target was at risk, he said,
"Take the shot."
Wicker inhaled a slow, steady breath and then stopped all movement. Gently, evenly, his left index finger increased its pressure on the metal trigger. There was the gentlest of clicks, and then a thunderous report as the massive 57-inch rifle let loose its raucous grade-A round. The crack of the 50-caliber round shattered the calm of dawn and sent every bird in the valley screeching into the air. One second, the general was standing there, yelling at his subordinate, and then, in the blink of an eye, he was yanked as if by some unseen force off his feet. There was a full second or two of confused inaction as brains tried to process the strange thing their eyes had just witnessed. Only Rapp knew what had happened. He was already moving, not toward the chopper, but in the opposite direction. The force with which the general's body was propelled to the ground suggested that Wicker's shot had done the job, but Rapp wanted to make sure, and he also wanted to have a word with Colonel Barboza before things got really ugly. The original plan was to be in the air when the shot was taken, but Rapp had seen an opportunity and taken it. He reached Barboza just as the general's aide-de-camp began to realize what had happened. The lieutenant, after all, had the best view of the general's body. Rapp had his eyes on him as he reached Barboza's side. He could tell by the look of absolute shock on the young Filipino's face that it was likely his commanding officer had suffered a mortal wound. Rapp grabbed Barboza by the arm, pulling him toward the fallen general. In a low voice, he urged, "You have to take charge. There are enemy snipers in the hills. Get these men moving and then start chewing some ass." Rapp propelled him forward, and the two men broke into a run. Barboza's mind was moving fast, already wondering if this mysterious American knew more than he was letting on. Those questions would have to wait until later, for indeed it did appear that there was a sniper about. And nothing made a professional soldier's skin crawl more than the specter of an enemy sniper lurking nearby. Barboza had seen enough live combat to know a moving target was harder to hit than a stationary one, so he set a course for the shocked soldier in his path. Gathering speed, he literally tackled the general's aide-de-camp and sent him sprawling across the dew-laden grass. "Take cover, you fool! There is a sniper shooting at us!" Rapp ran past the fallen body of Moro, taking a quick look to make sure the job was done. The evidence was stark. The entire back half of the general's head was missing. As Rapp continued along the side of the general's tent, he felt nothing but satisfaction. Moro was a traitor to his country, his uniform, and to the best ally his country had ever known. He had spilled American blood to suit his own selfish desires, and now he was lying in an expanding pool of his own. He alone had chosen his treacherous path. Chapter 30. David turned sideways on the plush leather seat. He had put a lot of thought into this moment while he'd been driven all over the West Bank. From this position, he could better access the knife concealed in the heel of his right shoe. "Where is Hassan?" asked an agitated Atwa. David frowned and said, "I want you to know that I am not happy about this. It was he who provoked me. I simply responded in kind, and he, being the pea-brained thug that he is, decided to charge me."
"I said, where is he?" snapped Atwa.
David's fingers felt for the watch on his left wrist. "The last I saw of him, he was lying on the ground unconscious, but not seriously hurt."
"How?"
"I did it." David began pressing buttons on the watch. When he pressed the last button, he closed his eyes and bowed his head as if he were ashamed of what he'd done. The explosion rocked the car, catching Atwa completely off guard. As debris pelted the bulletproof plexiglass, David dug a thumbnail into the heel of his shoe and pried open the secret compartment. Deftly, he snatched a small, sturdy switchblade. Before Atwa knew what was happening, David was on top of him. His left forearm pinned Atwa's head against the side of the car, and the razor-sharp 3-inch blade slashed the older man's jugular vein deep and clean. Warm blood spurted from the wound and sprayed David in the face. As Atwa brought his hands up to cover the wound on the right side of his neck, David reached around the other side and slashed Atwa's left jugular vein. A fresh spray of blood erupted, splattering the window. The Director General of Mossad sprang to his feet. Leaning over the desk in front of him, he stared at one of the big screens with a maniacal intensity. He squinted his eyes in an attempt to decipher who the two men were who had just left the house. He swore one of them was Jabril Khattabi, and there was something familiar about the other man. Before he could make up his mind, they were gone, disappearing into the back seat of a parked car. Still on his feet and frowning, Friedman turned to the general on his left and barked, "Target that car!" Friedman returned his attention to the screen and the parked car, wondering if it were going to pull away from the house. Suddenly, without warning, there was a bright flash, and the entire street side of the house appeared to blow outward. The confused frown vanished as Friedman realized what had just happened. The room quickly erupted in frenzied conversation as tapes were rewound and new commands were barked. Friedman turned to the general and in earnest said,
"Give the Apaches the green light."
"What about the car?" Friedman looked back at the screens. All he could see was a cloud of dust and flames.
He was fairly certain Jabril Khattabi was one of the men who had gotten into the car, and he had a good inkling who the second man might be. If it was who he thought, he doubted he would get another chance like this. With no reluctance, he said, "Destroy the car!" The analyst on Friedman's other side stood up and said, "What about our assets, sir? I'm almost positive he's in that car." Friedman ignored the analyst and, looking to the general, said, "My order stands." Ben Friedman would lose little sleep over the death of Jabril Khattabi. David stepped from the back of the Mercedes into a cloud of dust. His eyes fluttered but closed immediately, stinging from the cement, dust, and cordite. When he tried to take a breath, the result was much the same. Gasping through tight lips and clenched teeth, he brought his T-shirt up over his nose and mouth and tried again. After taking several breaths, he reached back in, grabbed Mohammed Atwa's body, and pulled him into the street. David could see almost nothing and stumbled over several chunks of stone as he dragged the body with him. To his left, through squinted eyes and the haze, he could see several pockets of fire where a house once stood. He stepped on something that gave a little, and on closer inspection, he discovered it was one of the men who had been standing guard at the door. David dropped Atwa next to the guard, and then moved away to the other side of the street and down several doors. According to his agreement with Friedman, he would wait around until the Israeli Defense Forces showed up and allow himself to be arrested. He was wondering how long it would take for them to fight their way through the roadblocks when he heard a horrible, shrieking noise. Instinctively, he dove to the ground, knowing what was about to follow.
Chapter 31. The Philippine Army helicopter approached the amphibious readiness group from the west. In the middle of the formation sat the intimidating USS Belleau Wood. Rapp couldn't wait for his transport to land. The morning had gone from bad to better to good to too good to be true, and then, just when things looked like they would all fall into place, he was thrown a curveball. A little more than an hour after General Moro had been nearly decapitated, Coleman called to report an interesting piece of information. Initially, he regarded the news of the Anderson family as a gift, but then Rapp began to see a problem. The Filipino Special Forces had been whipped into an uncontrollable frenzy by the death of their commanding officer, just as Rapp had hoped they'd be. The 200-plus man force began loading up for war. Two counter-sniper teams had been sent out to see what they could find, while Colonel Barboza took charge and prepared to send out additional patrols to find the enemy. The men wanted blood, and as soon as they got a whiff of their opponent, they were going to engage them with everything they had. Rapp had watched all this unfold with a feigned grave concern. Inside, he was very pleased. Everything seemed to be going according to plan. The Special Forces group would go after Abu Sayyaf with a rabid vengeance, and back in Manila, General Rizal would strongly advise that the U.S. military be allowed to join in the hunt. With this new cooperation, they would locate the Andersons, rescue them, and once and for all deal with Abu Sayyaf. Coleman changed all that when he called to inform Rapp of the vision he'd witnessed in the wet pre-dawn jungle of Dinagat Island. In addition, Coleman reported that the Abu Sayyaf camp was only 4 miles from the Filipino Special Forces camp. The original plan had been for Coleman and his team to take the shot and then move to the beach and swim out for an extraction. That was now off. Coleman did not want to lose contact with the Andersons, and Rapp agreed. So now, they were left with an enraged group of Filipino Special Forces soldiers who wanted revenge. Sitting between them and their retaliation just happened to be 4 U.S. covert operatives. In addition, the Filipino soldiers were so agitated that Rapp doubted they would perform a well-thought-out, deft hostage rescue once they found the Abu Sayyaf camp. If the two forces met, it could quickly disintegrate into a massacre with the odds of the Andersons making it out alive not good. Fate had moved all the players into a very tight area and moved up the timetable as well, and if Rapp couldn't rein in the Filipino soldiers, his trip to the opposite side of the globe could quickly become a disaster. Having just a few avenues open to him, and not able to talk freely at the Special Forces camp, Rapp made a single call. It was to his boss. Washington was 14 hours behind, so while Rapp was already starting his day in the Philippines, Irene Kennedy was ending hers at Langley. Rapp made 2 requests— The first was that she get General Flood to lean on General Rizal in Manila to keep his troops in camp until they could come up with a strategy. The second request now loomed large beneath him. The USS Belo Wood churned through the Philippine Sea at 12 knots, its massive twin screws leaving a white frothy wake as far as the eye could see. Her escort and support ships were arrayed around her in a diamond formation that stretched for miles. To the east, storm clouds loomed. Rapp cursed the weather at first, but then wondered if it could be used to their advantage. The Philippine Army helicopter landed on the massive non-skid deck of the USS Belo Wood, well forward of the looming superstructure. Mitch Rapp was out the door like a shot, heading straight for the only piece of ship that wasn't below decks. He'd been on U.S. naval warships before and knew for the most part where to go. When he neared the towering superstructure, a Navy lieutenant approached him and extended his hand. "Mr. Rapp," yelled the officer, "I'm Lieutenant Jackson. Damn pleased to meet you." Rapp allowed the officer to pump his hand with enthusiasm. Without having to look for the shiny trident on the officer's khaki uniform, Rapp immediately knew by the man's longish hair, physical build, and goatee that he was a SEAL. "You're just the man I wanted to see, Lieutenant." Jackson grinned. He, like most of his colleagues, knew all about Mitch Rapp. His appearance on the Belo Wood was a good sign. "My orders are to bring you straight to the captain's quarters." Jackson disappeared through the hatch, and Rapp followed him. They walked down the metal stairs for several decks, and then down a narrow passageway. They stopped in front of a gray door with the name Captain Forrester stenciled in black. Jackson rapped on the door twice with his knuckles and waited for permission to enter. It came almost instantly. Jackson crossed the threshold first and came to attention. He held a salute and said, "Captain, as you requested, Mr. Rapp." Captain Sherwin Forrester set down a book he was reading and stood. At 6'4", Forrester looked cramped aboard the space-conscious ship. The ceiling of his quarters was only a few inches from the top of his head. "Thank you, Lieutenant, as you were." Forrester strode across the blue carpet, raising a bushy eyebrow as he sized up his visitor. With a grin, he said, "Well, Mr. Rapp, today marks a first for me. In my 21 years of service, I have never received a direct call from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and most definitely not while I've been at sea." Rapp smiled. There was something instantly likable about Forrester. "Is that a good thing or a bad thing, sir?" Forrester chewed on the question for a second. "I don't like waiting around sitting on my hands, especially after what happened the other night. So I'm going to guess someone with a reputation like yours showing up on my ship like this just might be a good thing." Rapp nodded. It appeared Forrester was a warrior and not some bureaucrat masquerading as an officer. "I think you're going to like what I have to tell you." "Good. Let's sit down." The captain led the way over to a couch and four chairs. The suite wasn't big by normal standards, but as far as ships went, it was huge. Forrester and Jackson took the couch while Rapp sat across from them in an armchair. "So, Mr. Rapp," Forrester crossed his long legs, "what are you doing so far away from home?" Rapp had already thought about much of what lay ahead. It was going to be a busy day, and he needed these two men fully committed to what he would eventually propose. Having worked in an environment that was obsessed with secrets had not always gone over well with Rapp. He could appreciate the need for it, but there were times when the entire cause would be better served if the people in the field knew what was going on. In Rapp's mind, this was one of those cases. Plus, these two naval officers were not a security risk. They all wanted the same thing. In fact, Forrester and Jackson probably wanted it even more. They'd been out here on patrol for more than a month with the Anderson family fresh on their minds, and it had been their brethren who'd been gunned down on the beach not too many nights ago. They could be trusted. "What I'm about to tell you can't leave this room. In fact, if you breathe a word of it to anyone, it could end your career." Rapp clasped his hands in front of him and looked at both men to make sure they got his message. "Have I made myself clear enough?" They nodded. "Good." Looking at Forrester, Rapp said, "The SEALs you put ashore the other night that were ambushed, their mission was compromised by a leak that we traced all the way back to Washington." After a long pause, Forrester asked, Where?
The State Department. Some of this you're going to hear in the press. Assistant Secretary of State Amanda Petrie sat in on the National Security Council briefings on the operation. She was told point blank that she was not to share any information regarding the hostage rescue of the Anderson family with our embassy in Manila. Once the Andersons and all of our assets were safely out, we'd let the Filipino government know. If they got upset, Rapp shrugged his shoulders, our attitude was tough shit. The family's been held hostage for 6 damn months, and they haven't done shit to free them. In fact, we've discovered that they've actually hindered our efforts. Hindered was a kind choice of words. After our boys were ambushed, Director Kennedy launched an investigation. It appears that for some time she's had people at Langley monitoring the situation out here. What she discovered, you're not going to like. Prior to the rescue operation, Amanda Petrie emailed Ambassador Cox in Manila the general plans of the mission. Ambassador Cox, in turn, relayed this information to someone in the Philippine government. Who? Asked Jackson. After hesitating, Rapp replied, That I can't say.
Can't or won't? Asked the ship's captain.
Won't, conceded Rapp, but that doesn't matter. It's the next part that you're going to be most interested in. Have either of you met General Morrow? Forrester shook his head while Jackson said, Several times. What'd you think of him? Jackson seemed to consider the question carefully and then said, I think he had a real hard-on for me and my boys, a big chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, Rapp agreed, like maybe he didn't like Americans running around on his little island.
That and the fact that he was always trying to prove that his boys were better than us.
Rapp sensed some potentially important information here. Were they?
Jackson laughed.
No way!
Rapp hoped the answer was based on more than bravado and unit pride. Be more specific. How'd they shoot? How were they in the jungle? What was their discipline like?
They were extremely disciplined. Morrow was a real sadist in that regard. They were in great shape. They could handle the long marches with the big packs, and not one of them would piss and moan. I was a little disappointed in their shooting, but they don't fire anywhere near the amount of rounds as we do on the teams.
This was important information. How were they in the jungle? Were they good trackers?
It's funny you ask that, said Jackson, frowning. They were great trackers. They'd pick up shit in the jungle before every single guy in my platoon, with the exception of maybe one.
Why is that funny?
Well, if they were such good trackers, why was it that they could never pick up the Anderson's trail? A couple times we strolled into camps that had been hastily vacated, and I'd urge Morrow's men to press on, but there was always some excuse why we had to stay put. They'd sit on the radio for an hour waiting for orders while scouts fanned out looking for a trail.
Did you ever try to pursue on your own?
Jackson shot a sideways look at Forrester. Hell yeah! Morrow threw a real shit fit. He actually climbed into a chopper and came out to where we were. He reamed me in front of my men and his. Then he got a hold of my CO back in Guam and reamed him out, too. I ended up with a letter of instruction in my file, and now they won't let me off the ship.
Rapp smiled. Well, Lieutenant, I think I might be able to get that letter removed from your file.
Huh?
Asked a confused Jackson. Just remind me when this is all over, and I'll make sure the letter of instruction is purged. In fact, I'll make sure it's replaced with a commendation.
Rapp could tell Jackson wasn't following.
Your instincts were right, Lieutenant. General Morrow was a traitor.
Traitor?
That's right.
I noticed, started Captain Forrester, that you used the past tense in regard to the general status. Is that by accident or intentional?
This is where things got tricky. The problem was not in acknowledging Morrow's death. It would be public soon enough. The difficulty lay in who killed him and how they knew he was a traitor. Rapp decided to tell only part of the truth.
General Morrow has been accepting bribes from Abu Sayyaf.
Rapp left out the information about China. As you pointed out, Lieutenant, he has no love for Americans.
So Abu Sayyaf was paying him not to pursue them?
That's correct.
Why, that little...
Forrester interrupted the junior officer's cuss. Did General Morrow have anything to do with the ambush that was sprung on our men the other night?
I'm afraid so.
Forrester remained calm, despite the anger that boiled beneath the surface.
So back to my other question, is General Morrow still with us?
No, answered Rapp,
without the slightest hint of remorse. Jackson, knowing Rapp's reputation and that he'd been at the Special Forces camp this very morning, asked in a hopeful tone, "Did you kill him?" Forrester cleared his throat loudly and, eyeing Rapp, said, "Lieutenant, I don't think we want to ask that question." Rapp appreciated the captain's discretion. "That's all right. No, I didn't kill him. General Morrow was shot by a sniper." "A sniper?" repeated Jackson. "That's right. The camp's perimeter security was non-existent. Abu Sayyaf got someone in close enough, and they shot the general early this morning." Rapp paused to see how this was going over and added, "That's the official story. Now, would you like to hear what really happened?" Both men nodded, Jackson more enthusiastically than Forrester. "The information I'm about to share with you is highly classified. I can't stress this enough." Satisfied that they knew the stakes, he said, "In the pre-dawn hours this morning, a U.S. Special Forces sniper team was inserted onto the island. They moved into position, and sometime after sunup, they took the shot." Both officers took the news in silence. "That's not all, however. While moving into position, the team sighted the Anderson family and their captors. The four-man team split into two elements, one to follow the Andersons and the other to take out the general." "We know where the Andersons are?" asked a cautious Jackson. "Yep." Forrester uncrossed his legs and leaned forward.
"We know precisely where they are?"
"Precisely," replied Rapp. "And we're going to go get them." Chapter 32. Light flurries floated down from the chill March evening sky as black stretch limousines queued up along Pennsylvania Avenue, waiting to disgorge their important passengers under the north portico of the White House. The event was black tie, a state dinner for the Canadian Prime Minister. Irene Kennedy asked her driver to bring her around to the southwest gate. She didn't have time to wait in line. A private word with the president was needed before the festivities started. Trust was not something that came easily to the young director of the Central Intelligence Agency. She worked in a profession where things were not always as they first appeared, where people and countries were constantly attempting to deceive her, and even when she did trust someone, there were motives to consider. Mitch Rapp was one exception to her rule. He was one of the few people who Kennedy could rely on. God knows they had a different way of going about things, but Rapp was effective and his motives clear. He had nothing but disdain for the people who ran Washington. As the failed rescue mission in the Philippines had proved, the nation's capital had a habit of getting too many people and too many agencies involved in matters that could often be handled by a very small group. It didn't take a master of espionage to realize that the more players involved in an operation, the greater the chance for a leak. This, in essence, was why the director of the CIA needed to speak with the president and General Flood this evening. Rapp had called to give her the good news about the Andersons, but then had made a somewhat unorthodox request. At first, Kennedy didn't like it, but now, having had some time to think it through, she felt it held some real merit. It was classic Rapp, and one couldn't really argue with his track record. After a brief check by the Secret Service, the director's limousine was allowed admittance through the southwest gate. It pulled up West Executive Drive and stopped. Kennedy stepped from the back of the car, clutching her black velvet wrap tightly around her shoulders with one hand and holding up the hem of her full-length evening gown with the other. A uniformed Secret Service officer opened the door for her, and she hurried into the welcome warmth of the West Wing. Kennedy walked through the ground floor, past the White House mess and the Situation Room, and then up a flight of stairs and past the Cabinet Room. Outside, once again, she walked quickly down the colonnade. This was the way the president walked to and from work every day. She entered the White House, and waiting for her in the Tropical Palm Room was Special Agent Jack Warch, the man in charge of President Hayes's Secret Service detail.
"You look very nice this evening, Irene," the always gallant agent said.
"Thank you, Jack, and so do you."
Warch, like all the agents working the detail this evening, was dressed in formal attire. He offered his arm. "The President and General Flood are upstairs waiting for you."
Kennedy liked Warch. He was a hard-working professional who adored his family.
"How are Sheila and the kids?" asked Kennedy.
"They're doing well,
And Tommy? Warch was referring to Kennedy's 7-year-old son. Growing like a weed. Starting to get a little lippy. She shrugged. You know, all the stuff that goes along with being 7. Kennedy thought of adding that it might be nice to have a father around, but she didn't. It wasn't her style to act like a victim. They entered the elevator that would take them up to the 2nd floor of the residence. Warch placed his back to the wall and clasped his hands in front. "How's my favorite counterterrorism agent?" Kennedy looked at him sideways, wondering if the comment was merely conversational or if Warch knew what Rapp was up to. He knew Rapp fairly well, and in truth, Warch could be trusted, but he was not in a need-to-know position.
"He's fine."
Warch looked uncomfortable for a moment and then said, "His wife cornered me just a few minutes ago. She wanted to know where Mitch is."
"And?"
asked Kennedy. The elevator stopped and the door opened.
"I told her I have no idea."
Kennedy stepped into the hall first.
"Do you have any idea?"
Warch frowned.
"No."
"Good,"
said Kennedy with a curt nod. They both walked across the wide hallway that was more like a living room and stopped outside the door to the president's study. "Irene," the agent said in a concerned voice, "I think someone needs to have a talk with Anna."
"How so?"
"I just think you should talk to her."
"And tell her about what covert operations the CIA is running?" asked Kennedy in a sarcastic tone.
"No." Warch's face twisted in disagreement. "Of course not, but someone needs to tell her to stop asking all these questions."
"She's a reporter. That's what she does for a living."
"I know, but it's her husband, for Christ's sake, so it's only going to get worse. I think a little reassurance from you would go a long way."
Kennedy thought about what she might say.
"She's here tonight?"
"Yep."
On second thought, with Mitch out of town, this might be the perfect opportunity for her to set a few things straight with his wife. There had been a noticeable chill between the two of them, and since both would be involved in Rapp's life for some time, maybe now was a good time for them to talk.
"All right, I'll try to have a talk with her later."
Warch knocked on the door to the study, waited for a second, and then turned the old brass knob and opened the door. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Commander-in-Chief were sitting by the fireplace, playing a game of cards. General Flood had a glass half-filled with a brown liquid that Kennedy guessed to be Knob Creek bourbon. As for what the president had in his glass, he had no idea. He was a social drinker with no particular favorite. She'd seen him drink wine, both red and white, beer, vodka, scotch, and bourbon, but she'd never seen him exhibit a single sign of inebriation other than a tendency to get a little more vociferous than normal. Both gentlemen stood and complimented the director of the CIA on how nice she looked. Kennedy reciprocated and took a seat on the couch while the president poured her a vodka on the rocks. Kennedy had learned that it was better to accept the drink and nurse it rather than decline and have to reaffirm that she didn't want a drink 5 more times. The president settled back into his chair and picked up his hand. Looking over the top of the cards, he asked, "Whose turn is it?"
"It's yours," replied the general.
Hayes started to pluck a card and then decided to put it back.
"So, Irene, what's on your mind?"
"We have a situation, sir, that I think you need to be aware of."
Kennedy looked briefly at General Flood to see if he'd told the president of their earlier conversation. He gave her no sign that he had. Kennedy looked back to the president, who had finally decided on a car to get rid of.
"Several hours before dawn in the Philippines, we inserted a team into the jungle of Dinagat Island to take care of the situation with General Moro. While en route to their primary objective, the team stumbled across hostile forces that they identified as a column of Abu Sayyaf guerrillas."
Hayes set his cards down. He did not like the way this sounded. The last thing he needed right now were more U.S. forces killed in the Philippines.
"Please tell me there wasn't another ambush."
"No, sir, there wasn't. The team was not sighted by the opposing force. They allowed the column to pass and then went on to complete their primary objective."
Hayes looked a little confused.
"Then what's the problem?"
"Well," Kennedy thought about it for a second, "I'd say it's more of an opportunity, sir, than a problem."
The president looked intrigued.
"Let's hear it."
The enemy column was transporting the Anderson family, all five of them.
"You're serious?" asked a suddenly eager president.
Kennedy found the question a little strange, since she was not known for her sense of humor. "Yes, sir. The team split into two groups of two. One group went on to complete the primary mission, while the other trailed the enemy column."
Now on the edge of his seat, Hayes asked, "Do we know where they are?"
Smiling slightly, she answered, "We have eyes on intelligence, sir. We know exactly where they are, GPS coordinates and all."
Hayes stood abruptly. A day hadn't passed in the last 6 months where he hadn't thought of that poor family. "I want the National Security Council convened in the Situation Room in 1 hour. Hayes checked his watch. "I'll find an excuse to get over..."
The president noticed Kennedy wincing slightly.
"What's wrong?"
"I don't think we should go into crisis mode just yet."
Now the president was really confused.
"Why not?" "Mitch has requested that we keep this very low-key. He's on board the Belleau Wood right now, doing a tactical assessment while our team is on the ground, giving him a constant stream of intel on the target."
"What exactly do you mean by low-key?" asked Hayes.
Kennedy hesitated and then asked,
"Do you trust Mitch, sir?"
"Of course I do."
"Well, he thinks that the Belleau Wood battle group has all the assets we need to pull off a successful hostage rescue, and in light of what happened the other night, he thinks it best not to get the entire national security apparatus involved." Hayes folded his arms across his chest and stared into space for a moment. It was obvious he was torn between his trust for Rapp and his natural instinct to manage the situation.
"What type of timetable are we looking at?"
"The Philippines are 14 hours ahead of us, sir. It's tomorrow morning there." Kennedy adjusted her glasses. "The earliest we'd launch a rescue operation is after sundown, which gives us at least 11 hours to prepare. Mitch is proposing that we give him the authority to put a plan together on site, and then report to us tomorrow morning, our time, before we launch the rescue." Hayes thought about this for a moment, and then turned to General Flood.
"What do you think?"
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs looked at Kennedy.
"What are we up against?"
"Enemy strength is estimated at 60 armed men, light machine guns mostly, and a few RPGs."
As a soldier who'd been in battle, Flood was not a fan of micromanaging situations from thousands of miles away. He thought about the assets available and said,
"The Belleau Wood has more than enough muscle to handle the job, sir. She has a task unit on board, along with a platoon of forest reconnaissance Marines, and there's also an entire battalion of Marines on board for backup if things get hairy."
Hayes shifted his weight from one leg to the other.
"What's your recommendation?"
Flood checked his watch.
"I'd say let Mitch put a plan together. We can convene in the Situation Room in the morning and get a briefing before we give it a green light. Until then, the best thing we can do is stay out of their way."
The president stood in front of the fireplace, considering the advice he'd just been given. He shifted his gaze to Kennedy.
"Irene, I assume you agree?"
Kennedy's predecessor had taught her many valuable lessons. One of the better ones was that men of power were best persuaded by their own words.
"You've said it yourself before, sir. Mitch has a way of getting things done. I'd say the best person to handle this situation is right where we need him."
Hayes agreed with a curt nod.
"All right. Let's plan on convening tomorrow morning. In the meantime, I expect the two of you will monitor the situation closely."
Both Kennedy and Flood said they would.
"Good."
Hayes nodded and then said,
"All right, then. If you'll excuse me, I need to pick up my date."
Chapter 33. Flood and Kennedy took the elevator down to the first floor. For reasons of decorum and tone, more than for national security, a little subtlety was now called for. It was only one flight, but the stairs opened out onto the wide cross hall where visitors were gathered waiting for the band to play Hail to the Chief and watch the President, the First Lady, and the Canadian Prime Minister and his wife descend the long staircase. The crowd that was assembled in the cross hall consisted of foreign ambassadors, press, dignitaries, senators, congressmen, two Supreme Court justices, and a bevy of celebrities and wealthy contributors.
The sight of the director of the CIA and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs descending the stairs together would lead to endless speculation that a crisis was brewing. Kennedy and General Flood stepped from the elevator and were guided through the velvet ropes that cordoned off one end of the hallway. They'd gone no more than 15 feet through the well-dressed crowd when the general was snatched from Kennedy's side by the majority leader of the Senate. Kennedy didn't slow for a second, lest the senator pull her into the group and begin pumping her for information. In her mind, a state dinner was not the place to discuss national security. She continued into the East Room in search of a drink. Now that she was at the party itself, she felt an urge to take the edge off. She'd almost made it to the bar when a hand gripped her arm. Kennedy turned to see a familiar and often unfriendly face.
"Hello, Director Kennedy."
Kennedy looked at the dazzling green eyes of the young reporter and smiled.
"Anna, for the last time, please call me Irene. I'm just trying to be respectful," replied a less than sincere Anna Rapp.
She instinctively disliked her husband's boss. When pressed on the point by Mitch, she had to admit that much of it had to do with the fact that Kennedy knew him better than she did.
Kennedy frowned, not buying a word of it.
Cutting straight to the chase, Anna asked,
"Would you please tell me where my husband is?"
Looking at the pretty young reporter and thinking of her conversation with Jack Warch, Kennedy decided that now might be just the right time for the two of them to have a good talk.
"Anna, you look like you could use a drink." Grabbing her by the arm, Kennedy led her to the bar. "Two cosmopolitans, please."
The bartender nodded and went to work.
"Irene, officially I'm on duty. I don't think I should be drinking a cosmopolitan."
Kennedy glanced sideways at her.
"Anna, I'm always on duty, and no offense, but my job's a little more important than yours. Besides," she looked at Anna's strapless evening gown, "I don't think you're going to be standing outside in that little outfit, giving any live updates."
Anna was slightly caught off guard by both the tone and the message. This was the most she'd ever heard from the always polite but tight-lipped Kennedy.
"No, it's not that. It's just that whenever I'm at the White House, officially, I'm working."
Kennedy ignored her, grabbed the two martini glasses from the bartender and handed one to Anna.
"Follow me."
Through the thickening crowd, they went in search of a quiet place to talk. They garnered more than a few glances. Both attractive women in their own right, Anna Rapp stunning and recognized by almost all, Irene Kennedy classy and reserved, and also recognized by all, though for vastly different reasons. As they continued through the East Room, several people tried to stop Kennedy. Each time she smiled, apologized, and kept moving. At the southern end of the opulent room, they found a quiet spot and turned to face each other. Kennedy held up her glass and, in a conciliatory tone, she said, "To your husband, one of the finest men I've ever known." Anna wasn't sure how much she was supposed to read into the comment, but before she had time to really think about it, Kennedy touched her glass and it was time to drink. The cold, fruit-tinged vodka went down smoothly. In a less confrontational voice, the reporter asked,
"So tell me, where have you sent my husband off to this time?"
Kennedy took another sip while she thought of how best to handle this. Deciding on a bit of an unusual course, she asked,
"Didn't he tell you?"
This threw Anna for a bit of a loop, and then she caught the sarcasm.
"No, he didn't tell me, and you know he didn't, so why don't you?"
Kennedy literally never lost her temper. But this pushy reporter was begging to be put in her place. Where this lack of emotional control originated from, she wasn't exactly sure, but she could hazard a guess. It lay somewhere in the belief that Mitch deserved better. In a chilly tone, she asked,
"Do you have any respect whatsoever for your husband?"
"Of course I respect him," snapped Anna.
"Then why do you put him at risk by walking around like a put-off high school homecoming queen?"
Anna bristled at the comment.
"Don't condescend to me, Irene. This is my husband we're talking about."
"Exactly."
Kennedy moved in closer. "And if you really cared about him, you'd stop asking people where he is. You'd remember that he's very good at what he does, and you'd honor him by keeping your mouth shut."
Kennedy leaned in, so her face was just inches from Anna's, and in a low, angry voice said, "His job is infinitely more important than both yours and mine.
Do you have any idea how many lives he's saved over the years?"
Kennedy saw the defiance in Anna's eyes and said, "Sure, all your friends in the media like to call him an assassin, but have they ever stopped to count the lives he saved?"
Kennedy didn't pause long enough to give her a chance to answer. "Of course they haven't. He didn't just save your life that day upstairs. He saved dozens. Have you ever stopped to ask yourself that maybe right now he's doing exactly that? That he's saving lives?"
Kennedy eased back a bit and looked over her shoulder to see if anyone was trying to eavesdrop. Turning back to Anna, she added, "Right now, there's a family of Americans whose lives depend on your husband. A mother and father and three little children. Think about that for a minute."
Kennedy looked at Anna with commanding eyes. "Would you deny them the same gift of life that Mitch gave you?"
Anna was completely caught off guard. She knew that Kennedy was scheduled to attend the dinner. She had rehearsed this confrontation several times, and it never played out this way. At no time was she ever supposed to be on the defensive. Kennedy was supposed to be backpedaling. Kennedy was supposed to be listening. Anna was supposed to be in control. Slowly, Anna began shaking her head. Her mind was flooded with memories of that night not so long ago when Mitch had saved her life. Her thoughts turned to the Anderson family that had gone missing in the Philippines. They had to be who Kennedy was talking about. She'd seen photos of them and their cute little red-headed children. Anna could not deny them their best hope. Standing up a bit straighter, she struggled to find the right words.
"Just knowing where he is and what he's doing helps."
Kennedy nodded, satisfied that she had got the young reporter to think of more than herself.
"But I worry about him."
Anna thought of her honeymoon and her husband's scarred body. Her eyes moistened.
"I worry that one of these times he's not going to come home."
Kennedy honestly felt for the young bride. Clasping Anna's shoulder, she smiled and said, "I used to worry about him, too, until I realized that it's the other guys who are in trouble." Anna dabbed a tear from the corner of her eye and said sarcastically,
"Great, that makes me feel much better."
Kennedy smiled.
"Don't worry about him.
I can tell you that he's nowhere near the action. He's helping plan the rescue, but will not be participating in it." Distrustful but hopeful, Anna asked,
"Really?"
"Yes," nodded Kennedy.
Anna let out a heavy sigh of relief. "Good. I just don't know if I could bear losing him."
Kennedy tried to see things through Anna's eyes. It had been so long since she'd been in love, and it was a very real possibility that she had never felt as deeply for her husband as Anna did for Mitch. Theirs was a passionate marriage, born in the heat of battle. He had saved her life, and then she had given him the one thing he secretly yearned for, a real life. There had been plenty of times when Kennedy had worried about Rapp when he was on operations. She loved him like a brother and stayed up late at night hoping he would return safely. Kennedy gave Anna an unusually warm smile and said,
"I know how much he means to you. And if at any time I can help ease some of your worries, if I can answer some of your questions, then I will."
Anna was shocked by the generous and uncharacteristic offer. All she could do was smile and say thank you.
"All off the record, and never to be discussed with anyone else, of course,"
Kennedy said with a very serious expression.
"Of course."
Anna took a drink of her cosmopolitan and studied her husband's boss. Maybe she'd misjudged Irene Kennedy.
This ends Disc 5.